My name is Gene Duffy, and I'm an alcoholic. And in identifying as an alcoholic, I based that identification on my interpretation of the definition of the word alcoholic, as it's defined in the third chapter of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, wherein it says that we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. It makes no reference to how much I drank, what I drank, or where I drank, or what happened as a result of my drinking. It doesn't say in order to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous or identify as an alcoholic, I got to drink wine, live on skid row, go to jails, institutions, marry the same woman two or three times, or whatever, you know. I can only assume that those things can happen to anybody that drinks, puts needles in their arms, jams stuff up their nose, and smokes them funny little cigarettes, you know. Like everybody in here, I never intended to be an alcoholic. And if given the option, I certainly would have put this at the bottom of the list. I was reminded here just yesterday of something I'd like to share with you this evening. Often, you know, in our sobriety, people will say to us, don't you drink anymore? Or why don't you drink? Or how come you don't drink anymore? And I'll tell you how that happened to me just the other day. I live in Northern California, about 80 miles north of San Francisco, in what is called the wine country, the Napa Valley. And as a matter of fact, right here, you have a crew that comes up there all the time in my backyard and films a TV series called Falcon Crest. And I have lunch when I'm in town at the same restaurant that I've been eating at for about the last 20 years, I guess. It's a very nice, old, kind Italian restaurant. And most of my non-alcoholic friends who I have lunch with are all actively engaged in the wine industry and very well known throughout the world for their contributions in the wine industry. And I'm the only one at this table of 12. It's a round table, so it looks like something you'd see in Camelot, you know, with King Arthur and them guys. And I'm the only one that doesn't drink. And often, when one of my friends has a visitor from Europe or someplace visiting, inevitably they seem to notice that my wine glass is always turned upside down, and they inevitably say, "Don't you drink? Don't you drink?" Because all these other guys, you know, have brought in their own house wines, their finest wines, and they drink corkage, and there I am, you know, with the iced tea bit, and it almost amazes some of these people that I don't drink. And then inevitably some idiot says, "Why not?" And, you know, that poses sort of a problem. Why don't we not drink? Is it because I'm an alcoholic? Hell, I drank plenty as an alcoholic. You know? And it certainly isn't because I can't drink. That's our problem. We can drink. And then we say it's a choice that we make. And I don't really want to get into any AA rhetoric in my explanation to these people. And I don't want to have to go up and say, "Well, I can't safely predict the outcome of any drink I take, you know." And so I lie. That's the easiest way out, you know. I say, "Well, I'm going to the dentist, and the dentist that I had doesn't like the smell of alcohol. Or I'm going over to my mother-in-law's house, and she doesn't tolerate drinking. Or I've given it up for Lent." And that's a little tough in December, but... I know why I don't drink. But you see, I don't have much of an education, which will be very obvious to you shortly. And it's always been difficult for me to express my true feelings. Down in my gut, in my heart, I know why when I woke up this morning I chose not to put a needle in my arm or cut a line, take a drink or whatever. I know why I did that. But to tell somebody it was always difficult. Until about 8 or 9 years ago, something came to pass as a result of an AA activity that made it so simple for me, and I'd like to share that with you. I was invited to participate in an AA activity in a town called Stockton, California. Now, mind you, Stockton isn't exactly the Riviera, you know. As a matter of fact, Stockton is about as exciting as an empty paint can, you know. For fun and games in Stockton, you go through the work clothes department of the JCPenney store, you know. And I was sort of holed up in Stockton for this afternoon, waiting for this gala event to take place that night, and I was trying to pass the time of day watching one of them Saturday afternoon classics on TV. You know, something like Shirley Temple Makes It with Godzilla, or... And as I was watching the show, the commercial came on. And I know that each of you in this room has seen this commercial. And how ironic, because it advertises a beer. But it told the whole story for me, and I'm quite sure for you. The commercial, and I researched it because it had such an impact on my life, was actually filmed in San Francisco Bay. And it was filmed on one of them beautiful October days that we have up there when it's our summer, and the bay is just a sheet of blue glass, and all the little sailing boats are out there, look like a bunch of little butterflies flitting around there. And they zoomed in with a camera onto the decks of one of these sailing schooners, and on the deck of one of these sailing ships was a bunch of young lads, 18, 19, 21-year-old kids, running up and down the decks, and they had cut-off blue jeans on and funny little T-shirts and weird little hats, and they were climbing up on the mast and diving off the yardarms and swinging on the lines, dropping into the bay, just jackassing around, you know, having a big old time. And then the punchline came on, and it said, "You only go around once. Grab all of our gusto you can." And I didn't know what the hell gusto meant. And I went out to the desk, a little mama papa type motel where they had the apartment behind the desk, and I asked the lady behind the desk, "Would you have a dictionary by any chance?" And she went back in her little apartment, came back out with a little pocket-sized dictionary, and I looked up the word gusto. And the definition of gusto in her dictionary said, "A slang expression for living. You only go around once. Grab all the living you can." And that's why this morning I chose not to take that drink, not to put that needle in my arm or anything else. Because outside these doors, we all know, is a thing called life. The most precious thing that you or I will ever experience. And there's some facts that we have to accept. And I'll talk about reality, the reality of life. One to a customer. One time through is all you get. There's no, you know... Life isn't a VCR. You don't put it on rewind, pause, hold back, or fast play, or anything like that. Life goes by at its pace, not our pace. And there's some very cold facts about life. Roll this one around in your head if you want to lose a night's sleep. From the moment you're born, life begins to get shorter. That's right. Every unit of time, every measure of time that goes by is a part of your life that's over. It's done. It's finished. 30 and out. As opposed to night at midnight when you retire, as opposed to midnight last night, you will have used up 24 hours of your life. You will be 24 hours closer to the end of your life. And hey, I certainly can't speak for you, but I don't think I'm that unique, because I want every bit of that life I can get. Charlie, I want to go every place there is to go. I want to see everything there is to see. I want to read every book that was ever written, see every picture that was ever painted, sing every song that was ever written. Damn it, I want it all! And there certainly is nothing wrong with wanting it all, as long as you have enough sense to know you're not going to get it all. But how fortunate you and I are, as opposed to those so-called normies. We know something that they don't know. We know that we can get more of that life clean and sober than we can ever get drinking and using. We've already tried that. We're the luckiest people in the world, you and I. Do you know where you and I sit?
We sit at that very spot you've been crying for all your life. And all the normies are still out there crying for. How many times did you say in your past, Jesus Christ, if I only had a chance to do it all over again with what I know now? Well, Charlie, here you are. A chance to do it all over with what you know now. And as the young lady said, that's why I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Because it gave me that chance, as defined by Bill Wilson, not as a program for sober, not drunks, not as a detox facility, as a new way of life. A new way of life, not a penance, not a punishment, an opportunity. An opportunity to put it all back together. What do they call it? The wreckage of the past. And put this all back together into a beautiful thing called life, living with a capital dignity, a capital dignity. The life of the sober alcoholic. But how do you wind up in a situation where you got to be an Irish Roman Catholic and you're in a synagogue in West Los Angeles? I can only think if my mother only knew where I was now. Her rosary would twirl. Of course, I only say that in jest. I'm born and raised in the Lower East Side of New York City, which is not exactly Disneyland. And when I mentioned not having an education, you know, I'll tell you a little bit about that. You know, in every class of students, you can generally divide the class into three categories. There's the smart kids. Every class has a group of smart kids. And then there's the average kids. Then sprinkled in every class is a couple of dumb kids. The dummies. And I don't know if it's a birthright or what, but I'm a dumb kid. I was a dumb kid. Formal education was a very difficult thing for me. As a matter of fact, the New York State Board of Regents thought it was so difficult that they placed me in what they call special education. You out here in Beverly Hills know special education as welcome back, Cotter. Because that's the kind of a situation I was in. You didn't graduate from class to class. I stayed in the same room for 8 years, you know. And I really think that the determining factor about graduation was which came first, dating the teacher or smoking. And as soon as you did one or the other, out you went. Out you went. And then they scared the hell out of you because then they said you had to go to high school. Speaking of high schools, I went past a construction site a week ago in Marin County. When I come to the airport, I have to come down through the wine country, through Marin County, land of hot tubs and peacock feathers and things like that, and very affluent neighborhood. I went past the construction site. Where did you hear this? Maybe it won't shake up the ladies so much, but the guys will get it. Big construction site, and obviously they're building a high school. There's a sign right out in front of it. And only in Marin County would you hear this. Future site of the Francis W. Pennington High School. Can you imagine telling somebody you go to Francis W. Pennington High? You know? The logo on their football helmets must be a canary, you know? The high school I went to didn't even have a name. Had a number. I've often said if it had a name, it would have been something like Lucky Luciano Tech. Al Capone Prep. Driver's education in our high school was how to leave the scene of an accident. President of the senior class was a guy by the name of Vito. That ought to tell you everything. But when I was brought into that high school and I was told that I had to take a foreign language, that sort of seemed odd to me. It was a requirement to the New York State Board of Regents that all high school students take a foreign language. The reason it seems strange to me is I have been getting F in English for 8 years. And my older brother Jack wisely suggested that I take Spanish because the other choices were something like French, German, and whatever. And because I had been an altar boy and served on the altar of our church, knew the Latin of the Mass and the Confiteor and a few things like that, he
He thought perhaps the similarity between Latin and Spanish might help me. So as a freshman, I took Spanish 1. And as a sophomore, I took Spanish 1. And I took Spanish 1 when I was a junior. And I was still taking Spanish 1 when I was a senior. And that was in 1941, and I split from high school and I enlisted at 16 years of age in the United States Marine Corps. And I lost my virginity in a house of ill repute in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And I learned more Spanish that night than I did in the whole 4 years of high school. I bet you didn't know wow is a Spanish word, huh? And I certainly don't try to be vulgar to tell you that, because what I really want to tell you, the lesson that I learned from that, was to instill into me a strong belief in practical experience. And I honestly believe this. Now, I don't really mean that to be humorous, because when that time came for me, as it came for you, to face that sentence that's contained in the book, AA Comes of Age, where it says, generally a dilemma will precede our decision as to whether to continue on in our madness. And can you think of a better word to describe you and I as madness? Or reach out for recovery. When that time came for me, and I reached out for this program, I'm quite sure that if AA had been any other kind of a program than one based on the practical experiences of one alcoholic being shared with another, that if it had been an educational program where I had to read chapter 5 and then answer true or false to 20 questions, I think I'd be back in the penitentiary. Or if I had to read chapter 3 and then write a 500-word written composition on more about alcoholism, I'd probably be back on Chicago Skid Row for another year and a half. Or if I had to write a thesis at the end of the doctor's story, or whatever. If this had been a formal process of education, I would have died. I would have died. Because I couldn't understand many of the words. I couldn't understand many of the meanings of these words. And I consider myself amongst the most fortunate of men or women in AA. Because I was blessed by the company of 4 men. One who became my sponsor, and 3 who were very close to being a sponsor. And these men walked the words of the book. I saw the words in this book in action. I couldn't read them, but I could see them. The men who worked with me always spoke in the plural, never in the single. They always said, we are going to 30 meetings in 30 days. We are going to study these steps. We are going to do this. We are going to do that. And they walked me right through it. Certainly they come under the category of what we'd know in AA as sort of tough love, but tough love is probably the strongest display of affectionate love that I know. Because love to me, the definition that I abide by and I can understand for the word love, has nothing to do with motel rooms and the back seats of cars. Love to me is a genuine concern for the well-being of another. That's the kind of love that abounds in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But it wasn't unique only to AA. Our parents displayed tough love all during our lives. And we confused it then as we confused it early in our introduction to AA. Don't you remember when you was a little tot growing up, maybe Dad poked his head out the back window and said, get down out of that goddamn tree before you break your ass! And I hated him for that. And all he was trying to do was to keep me from falling out of a tree. Or my mother saying, it's raining, put on your rubbers! Ah, damn, why don't you put on them rubbers, you know. All she was trying to do was keep me from catching cold. Don't do this, don't do that. All displays of tough love.
And it's the same thing in AA today. Same thing. We're the biggest bunch of con men that we ever were, even though we're sober. In this display of love. You know what tough love is like? Imagine yourself for a moment, if you can, living in a beautiful ranch-style home high in the Sierras someplace. Beautiful California-style home. And you're up there now, you know, this time of the year, and the virgin snow is cascaded around, and it's laying all over the countryside there, and the sequoias are looming up in the air. And you're sitting right there in the living room of this beautiful home, and one whole wall to your right is a huge natural stone fireplace with a roaring flame going in it, you know, and a throw another log on the fire sort of a thing. And right out in front of you is a huge picture window. And you're sitting there and you're gazing out on this nature's splendor. And in the warmth of that room, in the protection of that room, you've got your little child, a little five-year-old kid. And he's playing there on the carpet in front of the fire with his little knockout toys or whatever you've given him for Christmas. And because you love this child, you've got that thermostat set at about 72, and you've got the doors closed so he doesn't get caught in any drafts, because you love him and you want to protect him. And then all of a sudden you look out the window and snowflakes are beginning to fall down and it looks beautiful out there. And because you love the little child, you want him to go out and experience the feeling of a snowdrop on his nose or something. But you're not going to put him out there in that little sunsuit that he's roaming around on the floors with, because it's cold out there. So you run into the closet, you get one of them little snowsuits out because you want to protect this child that you love. Now, I don't know how many of you who are native to California know anything about snowsuits, but I'm sort of an authority on them. I raised 3 sons in the Middle West, and I got a lot of experience on putting on kids' snowsuits. Now, the first thing you got to do is you got to turn them ass to you. And you lock them in your knees. Then you take one leg, you put it on and pull it up. Then you take the other leg and you put it on and you pull it up. Then you give it a little hitch to get over his hiney. And then you got to place 2 5-year-old arms in 2 sleeves. And that's when it gets interesting. You're up here and he's down here. And you smile. And then it's like that. And then it's like that. You smile a little bit more. And then you begin to get a little hot. You begin to boil. You get a little bit mad. And then all of a sudden, bang! You say, "Stand still, Derek!" And he freezes. And while he's frozen, you put this sleeve on. You put that sleeve on. You zip him up, put the hood on, tie it. You pat him on the butt, and you put him out in the cold. Fully protected because of your love. And out there he's saying, "What a son of a bitch I got for a father. I want to go live with Grandma. I hate my dad," you know, because he doesn't understand. And it's the same thing that we run into when we work with the newcomer. He doesn't understand. If new people could understand right off the bat, we wouldn't even have to have meetings. Because there's a very simple answer to our problem. Don't drink. It's amazing how simple the answer is. "Hey, what do I do to keep from drinking?" "Don't drink." And that's when they begin to squint. "What are you, a wise guy?" But that's why this is a program of a new way of life. A new way of life. You know, I've never been known to be a guy that had too much tact. And I love this program. And sometimes I get a little bit scared, maybe, that, and I certainly am guilty of it myself, that we don't turn our purpose into a minstrel show. That this is a very serious thing that causes us to gather here tonight. It's so serious that you and I know, or should know, based on our own experiences and the experiences of countless thousands of others who've gone before us, a very tragic fact that everybody in this room tonight
is not finished drinking. And everybody in this room tonight has not finished putting stuff in their arms or their nose. But there are people in this room right now, based only on our past experiences, that have probably made up their minds to drink again already. The lady over here is looking at me with daggers. Those words are not original thoughts of mine, young lady. Please don't think that. When you get home tonight, you open up the book. And in the fifth chapter, you'll hear this. Quote, and it was written over 50 years ago. Despite all that we can say, many who are real alcoholics, by every form of self-deception and experimentation, will try to prove themselves the exception to the rule. That's in the book. Now, why would anybody like you and I, sitting out here apparently sane and with reason, why would any of us choose to go back to that? And you know what's scary about that thing that they call slips? That decision to drink again? That's made when you're sober. You decide to drink again when you are sober. I guess that's as good enough reason for going to meetings as I know. To be on guard that I don't make a decision like that. But I guess if the consensus of opinion was taken, why people return to drinking, they come up with that, well, hell, you know, I'd be a normal drinker again. Really? You know, people that are going to try to be normal drinkers obviously haven't watched any normal drinkers. Do you recall how normal drinkers drink? They leave half of the drink on the bar and go home. They say, night. They say other weird things. Oh, my God, they say weird things. Thanks a lot. Two's my limit. I've had enough. I'm driving. They put the cap back on bottles. They say, let's eat. I almost threw up when I said that. And that's what some of us are going to risk everything we've got in an attempt to become something that we wouldn't be able to tolerate for more than 3 seconds, the conditions that surround the normal drinking. But some of us will risk everything that we've got. You know, it's a whole different ballgame now if you've ever identified yourself as an alcoholic or any kind of an addict. The price is altogether different now. You remember you used to walk in them saloons and say, give me a double shot of VO and a little Budweiser for a kicker. You throw down a couple of bills, you know. Now it's a little different. A double shot of VO and a little Budweiser on the side. Here's my job. My house. My wife. My family. My kids. My self-respect. And you got to lay it all out there. And then you got to wait to see what the hell he's going to pick up. Because you don't know what he's going to pick up. Maybe he's just going to take the job and the wife. Or maybe he's going to take it all. Maybe he's going to take it all. I thoroughly and totally accept probably the oldest cliche in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that each of us certainly has another opportunity to get drunk. But there's no one in this room or any other room, any place, that knows whether or not he has another chance to recover. We may very well have run out of recoveries. We may have stopped one drink short of, one joint short of, one line short of. One more might have been it. Might have been it. And so I make them decisions every morning that I want to get a little bit out of life, a little bit out of life. Sometimes I think I get fanatic about it. That I get fanatic about this mania, you know, of
of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous gets me in a lot of trouble. A lot of trouble. I get embarrassed many, many places. I was telling Tom here just a week ago over there by Ontario that I was coming back from Atlanta, you know, and I'd been at an AA thing for 3 days, and you know how it is. You get up on a hell of a high for 3 days and meeting people and laughing, telling jokes, and everything's going fine, and then, boom, Sunday afternoon. All the air comes out of the balloon, you know, and then you're back to the cold, gray, bleak reality, you know. And I try to hold on to them highs, you know. And I was getting on the plane Monday morning, 10 after 7 in the morning. And I'm sitting down, I got the aisle seat, and there's 3 seats there, and pretty soon the biggest guy I ever saw in my life come in there. Well, they're all big in Texas, they have big hats on, big buckle on his. And he got the window seat. And I'm looking around hoping that, Christ, somebody from AA gets on the plane, maybe somebody going to Dallas or something. And I still had my damn badge on, you know. And nobody got on with a badge. And then pretty soon the plane took off, and here she comes down the aisle, old coffee, tea, or me, you know. And asked that ungodly question that nobody ever asked me when I was drinking. 7:10 in the morning. Would you care for a drink? And I says, no, thanks. I said, but I'd like a cup of coffee with some sugar in it. She says, fine. Then she looked in the text. She says, well, you have. And he thought for a minute. He said, I'll have a coffee with some sugar in it, too. And that sick antenna of mine went up, you know. Guy's on AA. But I'm not going to blow it, you know. I'm not going to come out strong and hit him. It might be a GSR or something. I don't do that, you know. I play that game that they want to play, you know, and she comes by with the coffee and hands me his, and I looked him square in the eye, you know, not realizing he's looking at my badge. And my badge never says Calistoga, it always says San Francisco on there. And I looked him square in the eye as I handed him the coffee, and I winked, and I said, easy does it. And he gave me one of them Alamo stares, you know, like that. A little while later, he dropped his lighter. And it rolled over by me, and I picked it up and gave him another wink. I said, first things first. Well, we went through about 3 or 4 of them little passages, and finally he put his coffee down. He said, you all trying to tell me something? And I shouldn't have winked then. I said, we belong to the same club. He's there, oh, we do. He said, what club are you talking about? I suppose he wanted me to say something like the Oil Barons Club or something, you know. I said, hey. Well, he must have knew what that was because he went off like a rocket. He went straight up, he hit his cowboy hat on the luggage compartment, and then at the top of his lungs, he says, God damn! You're trying to call me an alcoholic? And everybody in the plane turned around and looked at him. He said, what in the hell makes you think I'm an alcoholic? And I said, because you took the coffee. And he says, I like coffee. I said, but she asked if you wanted a drink. You could have had a drink instead. He said, well, I didn't want a drink. I said, well, that's for me. I can't have a drink because I'm an alcoholic. But if you're not an alcoholic, you could have had a drink. I said, if I wasn't an alcoholic, I would have had a lot of drink. And he got... And the last I saw him, he's going out to Jetway in Dallas. He had his garment bag and looking back at me. You know. But that's how it is. That's how it is. I didn't notice, you know, that there was any new people here tonight when they asked for you to raise your hands. But, you know, I was at a meeting here not too long ago, and I said something that I'd like to show you something. It's not profound, and it certainly probably isn't original. I don't even know where I got the idea unless it came through my God as I understand it. Sometimes people sit out here, and they're new, and they're young, and they're They're trying to figure, hey, am I in the right place, you know? None of these guys know. What the hell is this? You know, what do you mean, quit using? Jesus Christ. Let me show you something. It's my belief that in this room right now is probably more knowledge on alcohol, drug addiction, whatever the hell you want to call it, than all of the therapeutic programs in the state of California put together. More knowledge about it right here in this room. Let's face it, you know, that's who you are. And I'm in there with you. You know, we're the pros. We're the users, the pushers, the sellers, the slobs, the drunks. You know, name it, we've been there, right? So if there's any group of people, for God's sake, that knows anything about addictions, here it is. And now if you're new, I want to show you something. And don't ever forget what you're about to see. Because you're going to see it from the horse's mouth. Is there anyone in this room who could honestly attest to the fact by raising your hand that life is better for you when you drink and use, as opposed to when you're sober and clean? If so, please raise your hand. Thank you.